Next up is my friend, Bob Cottrell. And before he gets up here, when I was a 50-year-old, I've been nothing but a housewife. That man wrote a recommendation for me to get into law school based upon my genealogical research and writing, and I am deeply indebted to him. Maybe he regrets it. Maybe he thinks I shouldn't have. Anyway, Professor Robert Cottrell is the Harold Paul Green Research Professor of Law at George Washington University. His PhD in American Studies is from Yale. His law degree is from Georgetown University Law Center. He is the author of Brown versus Board of Education, Caste, Culture, and the Constitution in 2003, and Gun Control and the Constitution, Sources and Explorations on the Second Amendment, 1994. Professor Cottrell's topic this morning is revitalization of the militia. Please welcome Professor Cottrell. Do you need anything special?
No, I won't. Well, thank you. It's great to be here this morning. I want to thank Alice very much for the invitation to speak here. I'm glad to see so many able people who are going to work in labor in the vineyards of research on the Second Amendment and firearms policy, perhaps. Perhaps more broadly. It's a field which I think is of vital importance, a field which for too long had been, as Sanford Levinson once said, the embarrassing Second Amendment as far as the legal and indeed other academies were concerned, but one which I think over the last generation has truly come into its own and I think will continue to grow. To grow in importance. I believe that the victories in Heller and McDonald represented more than a victory for the right to keep and bear arms. They obviously did that and were critical in terms of that issue. But I think something more important was going on, which is these represented a victory, or victories, over a quite cynical, sleazy, and let me say, dangerous effort at judicial nullification. That is, Heller and McDonald, and particularly Heller, puts an end to something on the like 70 years of judicial nullification. That is, the Supreme Court hands down a decision in Miller, an ex parte case, one might add, and a somewhat ambiguous decision. And then the lower courts essentially proceed to spend decades, in essence, repealing a constitutional right without going through the process of a constitutional amendment. That is something which is incredibly dangerous and should shock and alarm anybody, regardless of where one might stand on the issue of firearms ownership. The only historical parallel that I can see to that effort was essentially what the courts, what the judiciary did with the 14th and 15th Amendments at the beginning of the 20th century. They were essentially dead letters in large sections of the country, particularly, obviously, with respect to their, if I may say, original purpose, the notion of racial equality in the Constitution. I find it amazing that people who considered themselves liberals would applaud that that effort that was occurring with respect to the Second Amendment in the decades after Miller, and not draw the obvious parallel with the 14th and 15th Amendments and ask if we can essentially repeal elements of the Constitution this way, what else can be repealed? The First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, what is safe? when the judiciary will ignore the central meaning of a constitutional provision. Now, with the victories, with the decisions in Heller and McDonald, come, of course, the question, well, now what? We've gotten the Supreme Court to say very narrowly, I might add, that there is an individual right in the Second Amendment, and that it indeed applies to both the federal and state governments. But where do we go from here? Now, we're already beginning to see a law review literature which is suggesting where we might go. We certainly have a debate going on over, okay, what should be the standards of review? Can we apply the traditional constitutional methodologies that have been developed with respect to other provisions of the Bill of Rights, and particularly the First Amendment? Can we use that methodology with respect to the Second Amendment? Will the Second Amendment, will the courts extend the Second Amendment beyond the basic issue of ownership of firearms in the home, which were the issue in both Heller and McDonald? Certainly, one can read the Scalia opinion, and probably should read the Scalia opinion, as suggesting that the right to keep and bear arms applies beyond the home. His talk about sensitive places clearly implies that there are a broad array of places which are non-sensitive places where one presumably could carry, but will the courts actually take that step is, of course, another question. Type of weapons, obviously, we've moved beyond, and Heller indeed moves beyond the Miller formulation of militarily useful weapons, or weapons which are useful for militia purposes, and moves into weapons which are in common use. And of course, the question will be, to what extent will the courts now follow that? Will the Supreme Court reiterate that? Evidently, one of the weapons in most common use these days is the AR-15. Horror of horrors, or right on, depending on your point of view on that particular situation. And, of course, there's the question, what are the penumbras of the Second Amendment? Does it take, are there implications beyond the simple right to have and perhaps the right to bear arms? I think these kinds of jurisprudential questions, what should the courts do with the right to keep and bear arms, are of critical importance. And I think the scholarship will bear fruit, or may very well bear fruit, in the future. Certainly those of us who started writing about the Second Amendment in the 80s and 90s were told by many of our colleagues, well, this is totally theoretical, this will never come to pass, it's interesting perhaps as a bit of history, and it's fine for you legal historians who really don't know any law anyway, and it's fine for you guys to go off and do that, but as a matter of real practical constitutional law, this is never going to happen. Well, surprise, surprise, it actually did. And so I think these questions are of critical importance, but let me say that I am somewhat cynical about how much fruit they will bear in the short run. The judiciary, I think, is still fundamentally hostile to the right to keep and bear arms. And by the way, we've seen evidence, not only liberal judges are hostile to it, but conservative jurists as well. It's sort of like the joke I always tell, in which I think there's quite a lot of truth. to it. The Second Amendment suffers because liberals don't like guns and conservatives don't like rights, at least those in the judiciary, at any rate. So I think that drive is still there. I think that at least in the near future, we're going to see a narrow Second Amendment coming out of the courts, and not the robust one that perhaps we might like. I hope I'm wrong, but I fear I'm right in this matter. Nonetheless, I think Heller and McDonald are of critical importance because one of the things that they do is to place the old effort of the gun control movement beyond the movement's reach, which is the movement that has developed since the 1960s, has not really been a gun control movement. The gun control might be defined as, well, we might have some kind of screening mechanism, licensing or registration or whatnot. We can debate, you know, how good or how bad those particular measures are. But the gun control movement, by its own words, has always been, frankly, a prohibition movement with the idea of one kind of screening measure or another simply as a way station on the road to ultimate prohibition. Heller and McDonald take that off the table, which, by the way, is also going to be one of the reasons why we should be prepared for a counterattack against Heller and McDonald, precisely for that reason. But assuming that Heller and McDonald hold, I don't see it being expanded by the court significantly in the near future. In my view, if we want a robust Second Amendment and a robust enforcement of the Second Amendment, it's going to come from legislative action and not court action. I do not expect that the courts are going to give the kind of robust enforcement to the Second Amendment that we've seen with other elements of the Bill of Rights, though if you've looked for your Fourth Amendment lately, I'm not at all sure how robust that is. But there is, I think, a precedent for the enforcement of a constitutional amendment predominantly by Congress. If we look at the area of voting rights, it's clear that the Voting Rights Act of 1965 has had a far more important impact on minority voting rights than judicial enforcement of the 15th Amendment. It's been congressional legislation and not judicial action which has played the primary role. In my view, supporters of the Second Amendment are going to have to go to Congress repeatedly seeking civil rights legislation, recognizing that the courts are not likely to be a very particularly strong vehicle for the enforcement of the Second Amendment. And I think that's entirely appropriate. You know, one of the things that I think has happened since the passage enactment of the Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, is that the courts, in fact, have hijacked them, and particularly the Supreme Court has hijacked them, that initially Congress intended for Congress to be the primary vehicle for the enforcement of these amendments, as indeed we can see in looking at the actual text. Certainly Section 5 of the 14th Amendment gives ample power to Congress to enforce the 14th Amendment, including incorporation of the Bill of Rights. And with respect to the Second Amendment, the Commerce Clause, as it is now defined, and Congress's power to arm and discipline the militia are also bases of power that would enable Congress to embark on a program of enforcement and protection of Second Amendment rights. And that brings me to one kind of body of legislation that I think I would like to see explored, which is how do we revive the notion of the well-regulated militia? And the first question is, well, what is, in fact, a well-regulated militia? The gun control movement has essentially used the notion of a well-regulated militia to try and, in fact, deny the individual nature of the Second Amendment. It's not that they have any real interest in the notion of a well-regulated militia, it's just simply a tool that they believe they could use to in effect, destroy the Second Amendment. What would happen if we actually looked at the concept and asked, well, what might it mean in modern terms? I mean, I'm sure the first time any of us might propose it in a forum, a lot of opponents would say, well, do you intend to sort of stand in the town square with muskets waiting for the redcoats? Well, no, that's not what I would propose. But if we thought of the nature, the idea of the well-regulated militia, the fundamental idea behind it is community participation, citizen participation in the defense of the community. The notion being that the citizen is capable, is courageous, is able to play a part in the defense of his or her community. Now, that's an idea that is at sharp variance with much of modern liberal culture. In place of the courageous and capable citizen that people of the founding era believed in, there's now a belief in the feckless citizen, the helpless citizen, who must be protected, and even if not particularly well protected, must not at all costs be allowed to protect himself or herself. Professor Malcolm told us about modern England and how self-defense is equated with vigilantism. And in all too many venues in modern America, that equation is made. We have turned the cultural presumptions of the framers almost on their heads in terms of how we view the average citizen. Now, I suspect, having been to a number of these seminars at one time or another over the years, I suspect that most of you probably consider yourselves libertarians or conservatives and would think of, well, this idea of helplessness and this idea that the citizen should not be allowed to play a part in his or her defense is the natural outgrowth of the liberal nanny state. I tend to disagree with that, in part because I, at various points in time, I'm actually an advocate of the liberal nanny state at various points. I do believe in, for example, robust social welfare for people who are incapable of providing for themselves. I do want the various alphabet agencies looking at the purity of our food and the safety of our airlines and similar matters. But nonetheless, I don't think that the modern state, even the modern administrative and bureaucratic state, should encourage the degree of helplessness that we seem to have, particularly in some of our urban areas. And this idea of the helpless citizen, this idea of the feckless citizen, has led to what anybody should have to say are absolutely absurd results. For example, consider the issue of airline pilots and the question of hijacking. We have the authority dragging their feet on what is the most obvious common sense measure. Why aren't airline pilots armed? And I understand now for an airline pilot to get qualified to be armed, there's only one place in the country where he can go, a place in New Mexico, to qualify. There's some incredible training program that they have to go through, far beyond what police normally have to go through. Now let's consider, we're talking about a pilot turning around and shooting somebody who's entering the cockpit. You don't have to be Sergeant York to make that particular shot. Or we're also, you know, intensive psychological screening to make sure the pilot can handle a gun. He's handling the plane. Now, if that plane isn't exactly all there, please inform me before I get on the plane. I don't think that, you know, a person who can handle a 747 can probably handle a 38. I would think. Similarly, we have allowed whole inner city communities to, in effect, be run by gangs, by criminals, terrorizing the decent citizens in those communities. Why don't we develop more robust armed auxiliary programs for those communities? Why, over the last decade, when the National Guard has been sent overseas increasingly at a rate that hasn't occurred since the Second World War, why is it that we haven't developed home guard forces to supplement them? Why, by the way, at a time when our military bases are under attack by homegrown terrorists, don't we do what was once done in the armed forces and have, there's some talk of allowing soldiers who have concealed carry permits to carry. Why don't we do what we once did in the armed forces, which is have NCOs and officers carry sidearms at a minimum? To protect themselves and their troops. If you are in a combat zone, which unfortunately the United States in some respects can be seen as such, you arm your troops. If indeed the uniform is going to make you subject to attack, then arm yourself, which we don't do. This notion of the citizen as helpless has been so thoroughly ingrained in our culture that consider the following. It even extends beyond firearms. Hurricane Katrina, large thousands of people in a sports stadium needing to get out. Buses are available, but the drivers are not there, and so the people languish in the stadium. You go into the stadium and you say, how many of you people have driver's licenses? Get on the bus and we'll fill up the bus. You know, this is not rocket science, but we have developed a culture that says we cannot use the citizen. We cannot rely on the citizen. And by the way, that is the cultural impetus that was in fact behind and is still behind the gun control movement. The world will come to an end if we somehow empower the citizen to protect himself and protect his community. So let me say that I think that one of the things to do, and how might this notion of a well-regulated militia look in the 21st century? What sorts of things should we be looking at in terms of potential legislation? How do we develop full-fledged police reserves, individuals with the same police power as regular police officers? What I would call second-tier police reserves, that is, individuals who have training somewhat akin to private security guards and with limited arrest powers, but nonetheless the ability to do a limited degree of protection and armed protection of certain entities in institutions. Cooperative police-citizen training. We constantly are reading about situations where police come upon armed citizens who are defending themselves and they shoot the defender because they don't know who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. This can partly be corrected. It can't totally be corrected. I mean, police shoot each other. Police are constantly shooting undercover police officers. And that is an inherent danger. But we can reduce the number of these kinds of incidents if we, instead of police regarding the world as divided into perpetrators and victims, to realize also that there are, in fact, armed citizens defending themselves, and they develop training programs so that they can recognize each other. Just very simple, very quick example. You call 911, you're armed. You tell them that you're armed. You say, I'm wearing a funny red hat backwards or something, so that they know who the good guy is when they come there. You know, that might not be the right example, but the idea is that there's some communication. They just don't simply walk in there and not know who's who. They know who's who because, in fact, they're trained to ask questions. What do you look like? What kind of weapon are you holding? Where are you? What are you wearing? Recognize that the armed citizen is normal and natural, and that the police should, in fact, be prepared to encounter such. So my proposal is that we need to do more in terms of thinking of legislative ways to expand our Second Amendment rights. One of the ways we should do it is thinking of how to bring the citizen back into the business of both self and community defense.
Thank you very much. Anybody has questions?
Yes.
Bob, I don't know if you saw it out a year or two back. We had a paper in an article in America's First Freedom about the call up of unorganized militias during World War II. Several states, Maryland, Oregon, Alaska, actually called up their unorganized militia, something that had not been done in a very long time. I believe World War II was the last time that was done. It would be very interesting to see what has changed, what are the cultural factors that play a part in this, what you're describing, this view of the citizen as a helpless creature, unable to do anything. I really do get the impression some of it is related to the development of large dependent classes in urban centers. Because at the same time Katrina was hitting New Orleans and they had hundreds of school buses that they didn't have anyone to drive, the adjoining communities right across the border, which were largely rural, they were, if anything, more severely hit, and yet they managed to recover fairly quickly. There are certainly political advantages to creating dependency, creating people that are, in fact, helpless, and that you can regard as helpless. Yeah, and so that would be a fascinating thing for someone to examine. How do our laws reflect this increasing infantilization, you know what I'm trying to say?
Right, exactly.
Of populations, and how is this related to the need of the political class in major cities to have a kind of class?
I certainly wouldn't totally disagree with that. I still maintain that there is clearly a need or a role for
protection of dependent peoples.
Right.
But I think one of the things that we've done is we've extended it in many cases too far. You know, at one time we would have said, well, okay, this person is severely handicapped and therefore they are dependent. Or, you know, if you think of the original concept of welfare as relief, you're in a temporary distress, so you get relief and then you get off of it after a fairly short time. There is a connection to that. I don't want to overstate it though, but it is there. By the way, your World War II discussion is quite on point. Let me add another point to it. During the Second World War, if you were a yacht owner, the government would commission you in the Coast Guard Temporary Reserve, and they gave these people guns, that is, they cannons, machine guns, depth charges, and had them go patrol for submarines. You know, and one of them actually got a submarine. Theirs, not ours, I should add. The Civil Air Patrol as well. Could you imagine what the New York Times would have to say if we gave yacht owners and private plane owners bombs, automatic weapons, and whatnot, and told them to go get them? I mean,
blood would rip out their ears.
Yeah, you know, imagine Maureen Dowd's column with that.
This is sort of a follow-up on Clayton's piece, and it actually triggered something I've been thinking about. When you were talking about the dependency class, it struck me that there's always this division of thinking that doesn't come through particularly in the modern debate, but seems to me to be essential. That is, that the people who can take the view that Bob was suggesting, that there needs to be a decent social safety net, sometimes in the advocacy, sort of extend to their community this advice. Well, sit around, you maybe want to rely on this. I mean, we need good evidence of the necessity for a decent social safety net. But it always struck me that the advocacy ought to be different. That is, we're going to be here in the halls of Congress, we're going to advocate for a social safety net, but you on the ground, in your day-to-day life, ought to simply plan for the fact that there's going to be very little to come up. And then if something comes up, that's a great thing. Now, the actual point is that to pursue that idea, it strikes me that the people, folks in the Congressional Black Caucus, for example, who rightfully, I think, should be advocating for a kind of social safety net that would protect a particular class of folks, also ought to be advocating for things like you're talking about, Bob. That is, for example, something more elaborate than just a community watch system. That is, something that would engage the energies of people like Otis McDonald and Shelley Parker, and give sort of credence to the concerns of innocent folks, good, solid folks who are living in the middle of those communities. And the absence of that sort of second strand of advocacy seems to me to be sort of a missing component of the sort of modern establishment,
to be
the folks that I think you would
sort of defend. I thoroughly agree, and I think I would go even further, which is one of the questions we have to ask, I think, about inner city crime. And police will constantly tell you, well, you know, we can't get witnesses, we can't get cooperation. Well, you know, if I'm living in a neighborhood and I'm forced to be unarmed, and I know that all of the bad guys are armed and quite willing to kill me. I'm not going to cooperate with the police either. You know, it's absurd for them to sort of say, well, yes, we will protect you, which is, you can call 911 and wait, you know, 21 minutes, yeah. You know, when seconds count, the police are hours away. Who's going to cooperate with that? Yeah.
Follow on to that, I had a sheriff in Utah tell me that his only real function when there's violent crime is to bring the chalk because he's too far away from any place. But I've talked to different officers about their perceptions of the citizenry and what their responsibilities are. And I've heard some police officers are terrified of the notion of citizens doing anything because it makes their job, you know, scarier and less predictable. And then other officers that say, hey, I wish everyone's armed. My job would be a lot easier. I wish everyone would stand up for their community, stand up for their local shopkeepers, do those kind of things, make my job easier. And I can't think of a correlation off the top of my head between those two kind of guys. But how do we, I guess one aspect is, go about getting police officers in inner city areas, in other areas, to recognize what some officers I've spoken with do understand, is that citizens can be an extraordinarily valuable resource making their job better.
I think one of the things that we really should push for is to make that more of a part of police training. And by the way, in some ways, to sort of say, look, whether you like it or not, the population has this right. Let's figure out a way of developing a cooperative relationship. It's in your interest too. You don't want fratricide. And not only that, but let them in fact learn that it is a resource. I almost wonder if it is in some ways, if the relationship might be analogized to a regular army and how it reacts to the influx of citizen soldiers during a war. Draftees, wartime volunteers, reservists. You know, and at first they're suspicious of them, but ultimately they learn that they can rely on them, and the fact that they can't do the job without them.
This may be kind of cuckoo. More than once you've joked about gun coupons. We have food stamps and food coupons for people who...
Well, I said I'm a liberal. So.
Exactly. So,
gun stamps.
Well, that's historically a function of the colonial government is to have guns people.
But I mean, you say it as a joke. However, if we're going to ban poor quality guns, if you're poor, if you have not much money, and we're going to ban the poor quality guns, and we say we're banning them for safety, we say we're banning them because we don't want the gun to explode with the person. If we're going to ban those, and the people are poor, then what's
inexpensive guns?
Cheap.
Inexpensive.
Inexpensive. Guns that poor people can afford. Guns that poor people can afford. If we're going to ban those, and the excuse is usually, well, they're not good enough, you know. So if we're going to do that, what's wrong with the idea of gun stamps? Don Cates talked this morning about in Israel, which is very much a social state, and if you need a gun, you go down to the police station and you pick up your Uzi. So... we laugh at it.
Well, I've always thought, look, in a sound society, we have a debate between liberals and conservatives, and the liberals would argue for gun stamps, and the conservatives would say if we remove the restrictions from 1968 in terms of importation, the market would bring about high quality cheap firearms. You know, it would be a great debate, but unfortunately we're not that sound in society, so that's not the debate that we have. But yes.
Just two initial reactions, and I really like your ideas about revitalizing the militia in such a way that it strengthens the individual right. Mm-hmm. But how would you suggest preventing then that militia from being, in effect, usurped by police and being swept up in the phenomenon of over-criminalization, and instead just being a more expansive police force that could then in turn weaken the individual right?
Well, I guess, and here I'm going to put on a slightly libertarian hat, much as I hate to do so. I really think that we need to act. The way to prevent that is to actually really look at our criminal code and see to what extent can we start paring it back closer to the malum in se core. That is, we criminalize too many things, including guns in many cases. And it's not only a threat to individual liberties in many cases, but there's an opportunity cost. The more you're sort of regulating what everybody under the sun is doing, the less you're able to actually concentrate on real criminals who are committing real crimes. And so, you know, I think there are a lot of things we need to look at. I think also, we need to do more also in terms of informing juries, both of jury nullification, but also of the consequences of a guilty verdict. You know, if I'm sitting on a jury in Massachusetts and I'm told that somebody gets a mandatory year in prison for carrying a gun without a license, no matter what the circumstances or justification, as a juror, I'm going to have to think twice about that. And by the way, even more, how many people remember the Sylvester Lindsay case in Massachusetts? This was a man who had been under Dukakis, had been sentenced to a year in prison. Dukakis suspended it in part because he was running for president at the time. He was sentenced to a year in prison for defending himself with an unlicensed gun. He had carried it. And Massachusetts law said there was no wiggle room, no discretion on the part of the judge, et cetera, et cetera. I did some research on that case. Within 6 months, one way or the other of that, a man had been convicted of raping, forcible rape, of a five-year-old girl and gotten a suspended sentence. There is an incredible moral inversion in a society that says having a gun to defend yourself gets you a mandatory year in prison. Rape of a five-year-old child gets you a suspended sentence. And that's part of what I mean by we, one, need to re-examine a lot of the things we do in the criminal code. But also, I think the jury was originally meant to bring the common sense and morals of the community into the courtroom. And we keep them from knowing of this power. By the way, every other actor in the criminal justice system does know of their discretion. Police know of their ability not to arrest. District attorneys know of their ability not to bring charges. Judges know of their ability to dismiss. But the people who are supposed to represent us, the people in the courtroom, they're kept as ignorant as possible. It's absolutely incredible. Yes?
I had a negative conversation I checked in a bit in a minute, but I just had one story that I was reminded of by things you talked about, and the idea that the citizen should be involved in things. Years ago, I was planning on going trap shooting with some friends, so I live in Queens in New York, and so I went to Long Island to buy some ammo. And I'm online at the Sports Authority, and there's a guy that looks like me, but maybe 5 years older now. That guy probably has a family, two cars, a couple of kids. And I'm holding the boxes of shells in my hands, and he looks at me with this venomous hatred, like, and it was palpable, and he wanted me to sense it, that I was doing some sort of awful thing to the world, or something along these lines. And so, whatever, bought the shells, went home, and the next day, my friends and I got in my Bronco, and we drove to Pennsylvania, and we had six or eight or nine long guns in the back of the car. Of course, in the Bronco, you can look in and see them. And I was pulled over for speeding, as it were. And it was a young police officer comes and he asks for my license on the way back. He's looking in the car. And he sees all these guns in the back with ammo boxes. And he gets this look on his face and he runs back to his police car. And he doesn't get out until another police car pulls up. And an obviously experienced police officer gets out. He I think he even had his sergeant stripes on. Comes, he looks in the back of the car and does something like this. Ah, no, no problem. Gets in his car and drives away. And so there was an obvious, in my mind, difference in the attitudes towards people even having the means of violence in their hands, the citizenry, both between New York and Pennsylvania, and between the young and the old.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I have a point other than the story itself, but maybe there's something to be said about people who have that, what we believe to be the correct view, leading by example, or telling stories like this, or something along those lines.
Well, let me say, I think what you had to say about the generational view is very important. Look at the difference with the World War II generation and younger generations with regard to the ownership of arms. Could the World War II generation have been snookered into thinking that that semi-automatic rifles were automatic rifles, the way people have been subsequently snookered on that? And that's in part the lack of familiarity. Or even in terms of the federal government's attitude. One of the reasons we had large numbers of surplus military weapons from all over the world come into the United States is the Eisenhower administration said, well, you know, let them come here because they'll end up in the hands of American sportsmen and collectors. Whereas if they're abroad in the world, they'll get in the hands of revolutionary groups. I mean, and so, you know, I think basically the general said the boys earned them, let them have them, but, you know.
Thank you very much.